next case on our calendar this morning is State versus Patton. Good morning. The next matter on our calendar is State versus Patton. Please get settled while you are doing so. First, I want to welcome you to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. And while you are getting settled, remind you that you each have 15 minutes to present your argument. It's important that you make note of the time. It's in lights at the podium. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your arguments because they are being recorded. And finally, if you wish, you can adjust the podium to accommodate your height. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Brian Gladusky of the Kelsey Law Office. I represent Blake Patton, who is the defendant slash appellant in this matter. This is a case that involves the question of whether or not two offenses resulted from the same behavioral incident. My client was arrested on April 20th of 2018 for a hit and run. Actually, he was arrested for the DWI that occurred in Anoka County. He was subsequently charged about 60 days later by citation for a hit and run that had occurred a few minutes before and approximately 6.5 miles north in Isanti County.
Just to make sure I understand the issue, the issue in this case really isn't about serial prosecution. It is about the notion of there's no double punishment when you have two offenses or more arising out of the same behavioral incident.
Correct, Your Honor. The state may take a bit different position on that, but that's our position. At the point where my client was charged in Isanti County, I sent an email to both prosecutors indicating that I believed it may have been an oversight and I thought these incidents arose from the same behavioral incident. Each prosecutor indicated they disagreed with my take on the matter and each decided to pursue an independent prosecution. At that point, my client did plead guilty in Isanti County to a hit and run, and subsequently we filed a motion in Anoka County to dismiss based on 609.35.
Do you challenge any of the district court's findings of fact?
I do. I think that with the district court's findings of fact, they're inconsistent with the record that was supplied to the district court. The officer indicates he took the call at approximately 7:50 p.m., and there's another incident report, I believe it's document 57 in my materials, where it shows he arrived on the scene and made contact at 7:54.
Right, and I see the reference to 7:50 in the district court's finding, but there is no finding about when the officer appeared at that scene.
Correct, Your Honor.
So that, to that extent, there's error because it doesn't include the 7:54 arrival time.
I would argue that is an error, and the district court found that there was nothing to substantiate the timeline, and I believe that there is something to substantiate the timeline there. The state does bear the burden of proving by a preponderance here that the offenses were not part of the same behavioral incident. There are two cases, I believe, that are directly on point. One is the State v. Johnson. That's from 1966. That's a case where it involved two traffic offenses that were ultimately a single behavioral incident. The court set up a test which basically says it has to be substantially the same time, place, and an uninterrupted course of conduct manifesting an indivisible state of mind or coincident errors of judgment.
Are there any of the cases that you've cited or counsel for the state has cited where a distance of 6.5 miles would be considered substantially the same place?
There are not, Your Honor. One of the cases, the other case, Corning, does not state how long, what the time frame was.
Essentially, that was they came back to the original place, right?
Correct.
It was like a 3-block difference, I think, in that case.
And The 6.7 miles, here's where I think the district court also errs, is that the DWI was not, did not occur or happen 3 miles south into Anoka County. It's a continuous action. And with the DWI statute, and I'm going to address this in a moment, you can be charged with a DWI if you're over a .08 within 2 hours of driving. So part of the district court's analysis also stated that with regard to criminal rule of procedure 24.01, which states that the charge can be charged in any county where the offense was committed. And the district court, in my opinion, erroneously found that this event could not have been charged in Isanti County. I strongly disagree, as certainly it happened within 2 hours of driving in Isanti County.
Well, and I think your argument is not, this isn't a case where we're challenging serial prosecution anyway. So it really is about the double punishment, not so much who prosecuted what and where.
Well, I just wanted to point out, the district court did spend some time on this. They also cited the criminal statute 627.01, which in part states that the offense could have been prosecuted in any county where property is or has been located or services are provided. So actually, this event could have been prosecuted fully, both charges, in Isanti or Anoka County. Both prosecutors were aware of it. It's very similar to the facts in the Saylor case. They were made aware. They drafted the complaints. I brought it to their attention. They intentionally decided to pursue that. The state makes an argument in their brief where they're saying that my client essentially waived his right to challenge serialized prosecution and has waived that. And I would point out the difference in the Johnson case, where they said that Johnson, what he did is essentially ask to be serially prosecuted and then pled to a lesser offense in an attempt to escape the more serious offense. We did the opposite here. We asked them to charge them together. They decided to serially prosecute them. We had court in Isanti before we had court in Anoka. We took care of that event, and we did not do it in an attempt to gain an advantage. We actually asked them to charge them at the same time. I also briefly wanted to address the Ryland case. The state mentions the Ryland case and talks about that it would be a perversion of justice to allow a defendant to escape a more serious charge by pleading to a less serious charge. The Ryland case involved a case where a young lady had been hit by a car and actually died, and then there was a traffic offense. This is a DWI versus a hit and run. Certainly, while the DWI was charged as a gross misdemeanor, the conduct involved in the DWI is not any more serious. It would have been charged as a misdemeanor, but for my client had a prior, so it was charged more seriously, but the conduct itself would normally be a misdemeanor offense.
So I want to make sure, as I understand the district court, the district court concluded that these two offenses did not arise out of the same behavioral incident because they did not occur at substantially the same time and at the same place, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So the district court did not reach the second issue, and that is, if they did occur at the same time and, you know, substantially same location, did they arise out of continuous and uninterrupted course of conduct?
Correct.
So if we agree with you that the district court erred in terms of her conclusions on prong one of the test, would we then remand for the district court to go on and decide whether it was an uninterrupted course of conduct?
I suppose the court could remand. I also think the court could find from the record that it is the same course of conduct based on the case law that is out there in Johnson and Corning.
Let me just let you know kind of my biggest concern with your position, and then just I want you to address that if you would. So my understanding is while the state bore the burden at the district court, we have to give deference to those factual findings of the district judge, and it's got to be time and place and continuous course of conduct. And my concern is really on the place, because I'm looking at the findings that say the mileage itself is significant. The two crimes occurred at different places. And I understand what you're saying about the fact that it's two counties really significant or not. But given those findings that it's not a similar place, why do we need to look further than that before affirming?
Your Honor, I believe the district court errs in finding that it's not occurring at the same place. The DWI occurs up to 2 hours prior to driving. We're talking about a period of 4 minutes, maybe over a 6 mile period.
But doesn't the place, which I was talking about, that's about whether 6.5 miles is significant or not. And that's a factual finding that don't we have to give deference to?
If it was correct, I believe you would, Your Honor. What I'm saying is he was obviously intoxicated 6.5 miles north and 4 minutes prior when the hit and run occurred. He was intoxicated the entire period until he's ultimately met by law enforcement 6.5 miles south.
But he's found by law enforcement operating a vehicle while under the influence 6.5 miles away in a different county.
Correct.
So, and you don't quibble with the 6.5 distance, you quibble with the legal significance the district court attributed to that.
I do, and
how she interpreted that, whether that was a substantially the same place or not, or whether it made a difference because he was likely intoxicated minutes earlier in Isanti County as well.
Correct, Your Honor. I don't believe it makes a difference because he was intoxicated 6 miles prior, and we have these cases all the time where, you know, somebody's in a hit and run and they're found at their house, you know, 45 minutes later and they're charged with a DWI. That's why the statute's written the way it is, where they can be charged within 2 hours of driving. And I think it's disingenuous to say that there's no indicia that he was intoxicated when he was in the hit and run. Those cases are charged all the time, and, you know, defendants have the opportunity to make a post-consumption defense, and I would hate to be the defense attorney advancing that argument to a jury. Anything further?
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. Tyler Eubank for the state of Minnesota. May it please the court, counsel. The state of Minnesota would request that this court affirm the factual findings of the district court. The court must examine under State v. Johnson three prongs. Whether these crimes, the crime of hit and run, which occurred in Isanti, and the crime of DWI, which occurred in Anoka, whether those occurred in substantially the same place, number one. Number two, whether they occurred at substantially the same time. And number two, whether they arose from an uninterrupted course of conduct. There's one point that I would like to clear up right away, and that was the findings of the district court. The district court found that the two crimes occurred at substantial, did not, there's a double negative in here, so it will trip me up from time to time. They did not occur at substantially the same place. She relied on that county line and the mileage between the two. The court did not reach the question of time.
Right. That finding, I thought the findings were odd on that regard because the court in one finding says, yes, the call was made by the motorist involved in the hit and run at 7:50, and then there's a reference to the DWI arrest occurring at 8:30, but I don't think there's a finding that links those two.
Correct.
And there's no finding about the 7:54 when I think the record indicates police located Mr. Patton's vehicle.
That is correct. And I believe that the record establishes that they occurred at substantially different times.
How is 7:50 and 7:54 substantially different?
The officer responded at 7:50, I believe is what the record says, and arrived at the scene where Timothy was stopped at 7:54. The driving directions, which are provided to the court in the record at page 7, would indicate that between the spot of the hit and run and where he was eventually pulled over, it takes 8 minutes to drive that distance. Now, we know that it was not a straight line at all. What happened was The strike occurs in Isanti County. The appellant drives south on Highway 65. He's pursued by Timothy. He goes west down 237th and then goes south down Kumquat. Kumquat is a one-way street. He comes to the end of the street, turns around face to face with Timothy, and then goes through the ditch to escape. Timothy then loses sight of him, which I believe is the substantiating factor in this.
And only after that makes the call, the 911 call, at 7:50, correct?
I believe that is the inference. And then Sergeant Larson comes from the south up, meets with Timothy. Timothy gives a description of the vehicle, the driver, and the license plate number. The sergeant then goes and looks through this neighborhood north of 237th, where he runs into the appellant and makes the stop. So I believe that the time is more than 4 minutes between the call and the time that Sergeant Larson arrives at the scene, and is indeed more than 8 minutes. And if we're looking at some sort of fact to substantiate the difference, I think that fact is the fact that Timothy lost sight of the appellant during this course of action. The other prong that the district court reached was the court found that there was nothing in the record to support the fact that these arose from an uninterrupted course of conduct.
I don't think the court made a finding along that line, did it? Or addressed that second prong. At least I don't see it directly.
I believe what the court said was that it need not, but if it were to reach, if it were to examine that second prong, there's nothing in the record to establish that this resulted from an uninterrupted course of conduct. And that is because after taking that U-turn on Kumquat, Timothy and law enforcement lost sight of him as he went into this neighborhood north of 237th.
But isn't the uninterrupted course of conduct the fact that he's driving poorly because he's under the influence, which resulted in the property damage collision and resulted in the observed driving behavior and confirmation that, in fact, he was under the influence? How is that a different course of conduct?
I think that the substantiating factor in the case law, in my review of the case law with regard to an uninterrupted course of conduct, is essentially these cases fall into two buckets. On the one hand, there are cases like State v. Johnson, in which the officer observed the defendant drive across the lane and then go into a parking lot where he was pulled over, keeping an eye on the defendant during this entire time. Another case in which State v. Corning, which appellant cites, in which he went around the block, came back, and was pulled over there. Additional cases stated by the state, State v. Boucher, B-O-U-C-H-E-R, in which the driver is driving through Falcon Heights, St. Paul, and Minneapolis, but he's pursued by officers this entire time. So in those cases, law enforcement always has an eye on this person. They can always see what they're doing. In the other cases, you have State v. Ryland and State v. Coyman. In those cases, one involved a DWI and criminal negligence. The other involved a driving after revocation and criminal negligence. The courts in those two cases found that there was no interrupted course of conduct because they were unaware of when the driving after revocation occurred or when the public drunkenness occurred. And I believe that this case fits firmly into that second bucket because we are not sure where exactly that DWI occurred. We know for a fact that, I'm sorry.
I was going to ask, you make, the district court seems to give significance, and I think you do as well, to the fact that the two charged offenses occurred in different counties. How is that relevant to the two-factor test about whether this is the same behavioral incident?
I believe that if we're looking for a substantial fact to determine that these occur in different places, that is the substantial fact, because under State v. Fleck, and I believe it's dispositive here, the court says that 609.035 is not meant to amend our venue statutes, and it says that prohibiting one county from prosecuting a case that occurred within the county would not be in the interest of justice.
I have a question for you. Let's assume a hypothetical here that let's say that the driver is in one county is observed by a peace officer driving erratically, but he loses him, doesn't get a chance to arrest him. Then he drives into another county and is seen, say, a half an hour later and stopped and arrested. Is that one behavioral incident?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, both because of the half-hour time frame and also because there's no indication that's an uninterrupted course of conduct. During that half an hour, he could have been doing any manner of activity.
Meaning he could have gone and drank and the other more, or?
Yes, I believe that's the case. The state has the burden of proving venue beyond a reasonable doubt. I'll turn the court's attention to State v. Eichenstein, 690 Northwest 2nd, 140. That's a 2004 case from this court. So that would mean that the prosecution in Isanti would have a difficult time trying to prove that the DWI occurred in Isanti. All of the tests were conducted in Anoka by the St. Francis Police Department, the field sobriety test. He was then taken to the St. Francis Police Department where he was given his data master test.
Certainly easier to prove in it with the information generated in Anoka County.
Certainly easier to prove, and I would also be wary of, as counsel alluded to, a post-consumption defense. If he says, Isanti can't possibly be the venue of this because during that time that I disappeared in this neighborhood to the north, I was drinking. And I believe that's the substantial factor in the place analysis.
Well, let's take the hypothetical a little further. Let's assume that it's 20 miles between the two stops, and it takes 20 minutes to get there. The arrest takes place 20 minutes in a time difference. Is that one behavioral incident, or is it still different?
That is a closer question in my mind. If the officers are in view of the suspect during the entire time, then I would say that would fit more closely in with Johnson and particularly Beauchair, where he's driving from Roseville to Falcon Heights to Minneapolis to St. Paul. And if there are no more questions,
I have one. Would you agree with counsel for appellant that at the district court, the state had the burden of showing that it was not the same behavioral incident?
I do agree.
So I'm troubled reading, I think it's number 16 of the district court's findings of fact, and I think you alluded to this, where the district court said, look, I'm not reaching the, whether it's the continuing an uninterrupted course of conduct, but if I did, and then goes on, and then says, the record cannot show an uninterrupted course of conduct, that paragraph really makes me question whether the district court was shifting the burden, that and some of the other findings, from the state to the, here the appellant, to establish that it shifted the burden on the same behavioral incident. Could you give me your impression on that? Do you see what I'm saying?
I do see what you're saying, Your Honor. And I believe that the district court had held that the state had met its burden on the factor of the place. To the extent, and is merely commenting that the record does not support a finding of uninterrupted course of conduct.
So maybe the district court may have been wrong there, but it doesn't matter because that wasn't what the district court was basing its decision on.
I believe that would be harmless error, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, I will cede the rest of my time.
Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, you have your rebuttal period.
Thank you, Your Honors. The only thing I want to address again is this concept of place. I think the district court struggled with where the DWI occurred. And I would stress the DWI occurred the moment he got in that vehicle and continued until he was stopped by the police. When we're talking about the same place, he was certainly intoxicated at the time that that hit and run took place.
But the charge was DWI in Anoka County based on the officer's observations of him driving and the subsequent testing.
Actually, Your Honor, that's where there wasn't any conduct that was observed, only a driver's license plate and a description of the vehicle caused
the
stop.
Right, but they observed him driving, correct?
They did, but they didn't observe any conduct that would lead to a reasonable suspicion to pull him over. The only thing they had to base the stop on was that there was a reported hit and run, and that's where there's this continuous, indivisible.
The crime of DWI requires operation of a motor vehicle while intoxicated, which is what they observed firsthand in Anoka County but didn't in Isanti.
The crime requires that it be within 2 hours of driving.
Well, that's one of the charges. I mean, DWI comes in many forms, correct?
Correct. There's the generic under the influence charge, and then there's the charge that is the easier one to prove, is the 08 or more within 2 hours of driving. And that's where that charge would have been no more difficult to prove in Isanti County, that he was at a .13 6 minutes later in Anoka County. And likewise, the hit and run, because he was stopped in Anoka County, could have been charged in Anoka County. And that's why I tried to get everyone on the same page and said, hey, let's handle this in one place and one prosecution and not take up two court files and have my client pay two retainers and miss twice as much work. I mean, it's the exact reason that we have that statute.
Can you confirm for me, based on the record, not necessarily the court's findings, what's the timeline? The 750 is, that is the time, as I understand it, that the other driver made the 911 call to report the accident and that he tried to follow Mr. Patton and lost him. That's 750? What am I right about that?
That is, Your Honor. My understanding is that is when Officer Larson overheard dispatching an Anoka County deputy to the scene. He then also intervened.
What happened at 754?
That's when he arrives on the scene and makes contact with Mr. Patton, according to the state's records.
Okay, because the Respondents' Counsel said that's, in fact, when he met with the other driver. So we just need to check the record on that?
That certainly could be done, Your Honor.
But your understanding of the record is that 754 is when the officer encountered Mr. Patton.
Right. And the report indicates that he arrived and that it was cleared at 754.
And so your argument would be that's 4 minutes. That's substantially the same time.
Correct.
What does the record suggest in terms of the difference, or, you know, the timeline between when the accident occurred and when the and 750?
It doesn't, Your Honor. What it does indicate is that the caller was in real time on the phone with dispatch, and they were making a call for an officer, and he had been following him. I certainly would see it. It could have been 8 minutes, 7 minutes. It's in real time, though. Anything further?
I don't have anything further. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both for your arguments. They were helpful. We will issue our decision within the 90-day statutory period. Our next matter for oral argument is going to be presented by Interactive Video, so we will recess for that.